Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
We've got a new word for you today, ripped almost from the headlines, if you think about it. Petroconfidence, one of the world's biggest oil and gas suppliers, has been making news with its military. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, global provider of fuels, power, and energy services. Committed to sound, efficient, sustainable energy solutions. Constellation.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here on this Monday. It is the 11th of August today. The president of Georgia said today his country's been cut nearly in half by Russian troops. They've been on the offensive, the Russian troops have, since Thursday. So far, Russian Prime Minister Vladimir Putin has ignored calls by the G7 and this afternoon by President Bush to stop the attacks. It's a chain of events made possible largely by Russia's massive energy economy. Cliff Kupchan is the director of European and Eurasian Policy for the Eurasia Group. Mr. Kupchan, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
How nervous is this making you?
It's making me quite nervous. It is a unusual display of disproportionate force by a usually quite rational Russian leadership.
Why isn't it, though, having more of an impact on some of the economic indicators we would look at here? The price of oil is a great one. If this had happened with oil at $150 a barrel, there'd be a lot more screaming going on, don't you think?
There would be a lot more screaming going on. The fundamentals of the oil markets are in a bearish mode right now. There's a lot of downward pressure for a lot of reasons. And the Baku-Jehan pipeline that crosses Georgia is a million barrels a day. It's not that substantial when you look at global supply.
If you're Western Europe, though, and you're looking at Russia exert military force based on its economic power, what are you thinking?
In this case, Russia is exerting military force based on its military force. I don't think this has much to do with economic power. Georgia is right in the crosshairs of Russian geopolitical concerns. They still think it's their backyard. They own their backyard, and they want to keep their backyard.
Well, I guess my question is, 15 years ago, we wouldn't have seen this happening because Russia couldn't militarily do it because it didn't have the economic power.
I think that what's basically motivating this is a combination of dislike for President Saakashvili, anger over Georgia's desire to become a member of NATO, and sending a message to the West that Russia is again a major player. I think that the Europeans are going up to their eyeballs already. Russia supplies over 25% of European Union gas. They don't have a lot of good alternatives. Yes, they might be nervous. This is a Russia that's a bit out of control, but they don't really have any place else to go.
Do you think foreign companies, Western companies that might be eyeing Russian investments are given pause at this at all?
I don't think that the Georgian war alone is what's involved here. Let's not forget that Mr. Putin, several weeks ago, took the Russian stock market down by 15% with his comments about Mechel, a steel producer. Before that, there was the conflict over TNK-BP, the large oil company half-owned by a Western multinational. So I think the real perspective here is this is a trilogy. This is the Georgian War. This is Mechel Steel Company. This is TNK-BP. I think those three together are going to give Western corporates pause.
So what's the fourth chapter then in this trilogy?
I think that both portfolio investors and corporate investors are going to ask, is this Russian leadership committed to integrating with Western business? Is this a safe place for capital? Is Russia really an island of tranquility as it has been perceived through this credit crunch crisis? And the answer to that may well become no.
Who does that punish, though, economically? Do the Russians suffer or do Western companies who miss out on the opportunity suffer?
They both suffer. The Russians are so petro-confident right now that I don't think they know that they might suffer, nor do I think the Russians really care if they suffer in their own thinking. So it's a lose-lose, but it's one where the Russian side doesn't really know or care if it loses.
Cliff Kupchan at the Eurasia Group. Mr. Kupchan, thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Oil traders didn't pay any heed at all to what was happening in the Caucasus. Crude actually fell and closed under $115 a barrel today. Stocks were up, but not so much. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. part of what's going on with the oil prices I just mentioned is about the dollar. The greenback held steady today at about $1.50 to the euro. That's a dime better than it was a month ago. That is, the dollar's worth more now. We called George Feiger at Contango Capital Advisors for an explanation. First, though, he gave us a quick tutorial.
Well, an exchange rate is a pairwise calculation, right? It's how many pounds can you buy with a dollar? It's how many euros can you buy with a dollar? There isn't one number. So it's where you're sitting and where is their value in these currencies. And we're now swinging to a position where the dollar will look better value than a number of these other major currencies.
And then he gave us the why.
Eurozone economy is slowing down very rapidly and parts are in recession already. The British economy is slowing down extremely rapidly and the Japanese economy is again sliding into recession. And so money was flowing to these other places rather than to the U.S. Since these other places are becoming less attractive, that flow is going to diminish. And that's all that's moving the exchange rate, and that's all that always moves the exchange rate.
That was George Feiger at Contango Capital Advisors with today's foreign exchange lesson. Currency movements play into global trade in all kinds of ways, of course. So, too, does the old playground rule, the one about picking up your toys and going home if you don't like the rules of the game. Boeing has let it be known it's none too happy with some new Defense Department rules. The airplane maker's not denying reports out today that it's going to take a pass on bidding on a $35 billion contract for some new aerial refueling tankers for the Air Force. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale has that story.
Citing sources familiar with Boeing's internal discussions, Aviation Week reports the aircraft maker is strongly considering sitting out the next round of bidding for the contract, even after Boeing was able to get the Air Force to reopen bids when competitor Airbus won the first round. Late last week, the Defense Department proposed guidelines for new bids, and to Boeing's dismay, the Pentagon is giving extra points for a bigger tanker plane, which Airbus has. Lauren Thompson follows the long-running contract fight for the Lexington Institute.
Boeing's proposal was prepared for the first round of competition when there was no additional scoring for the bigger plane, and now it doesn't have time to change its proposal.
Boeing would not confirm or deny the options the company is considering. By maintaining the speculation that it might not submit another bid, Boeing is trying to put political pressure on the Defense Department, says aircraft industry analyst Richard Abulafia.
There's an aspect of this that's probably somewhat passive-aggressive, basically hoping to get their political allies to go to bat for them and introduce language that makes this, in their mind, more of a level playing field.
Boeing's congressional allies are trying to withhold funding for new tankers until Boeing has a chance to rework its design. But Airbus has its own political supporters, and Congress is unlikely to act before the end of the year, when the Pentagon hopes to announce the final contract winner. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Bigger, generally speaking, is better in business, even when the business is garbage. Or waste management, as the company in question would probably like us to say. Today, Waste Management Incorporated raised its unsolicited offer for this country's number two trash company. That would be Republic Services. They raised it 10%, which got us to wondering what effect a potential sanitation merger might have on the creators of a lot of that waste, you and me. From New York, Ashley Milne-Tite reports.
A lot depends on who owns your local landfill. 70% of landfill space is controlled by the big three private sector trash companies. Peter Anderson is executive director of the Center for a Competitive Waste Industry. He says independent and public landfills still have some room, but it's dwindling fast.
When the uncontrolled landfill fills up, the independent landfill fills up, that's the ticking time bomb.
Anderson says when those landfills run out of capacity, the big trash haulers can hold their smaller competitors to ransom.
And at that point in time, the small independent hauler will find when he goes to the landfill paying a tipping fee that is twice the rate that they're internally booking by the big guys, and they will not be able to compete.
When that happens, he says the big guys will be able to charge customers more. He's against the merger. So is Eric Lombardi. He runs EcoCycle, a recycling company based in Boulder. He says America should look for new, innovative approaches to getting rid of waste rather than just dumping it in a hole in the ground. And he doesn't expect much from an enlarged Waste Management Inc.
Waste management is not going to bring a lot of new ideas. When they are as big and they have as many bank loans to pay off and as many trucks and cities to service, they're going to stick with their business model, which is the one that's been working for the last 20 or 30 years.
Lombardi suggests the company adopt EcoCycle's business model of recycling virtually everything. He says he'd welcome a little more competition. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Shares of Apple picked up another 2.5% today, mainly because CEO Steve Jobs has figured out a way to make money almost without trying. We told you a couple of weeks ago about Apple's new App Store, where Apple lovers can buy fun new software for their iPhones and iPods. We learned today it's pulling down $1 million a day. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson has the story.
The App Store could easily be called the Game Store. One of the most popular downloads is Sega's latest time waster, Super Monkey Ball. For every software sale, the developer gets 70%, Apple gets 30%. But analyst Ben Beharin with Creative Strategies says Apple still comes out the winner since it controls its own hardware and software.
In a market that's as mature as we have right now with phones and PCs, differentiation is just absolutely critical. And you differentiate in hardware and you differentiate in software. And when you can combine those two together, you've got a very differentiated position.
And a way to stay ahead of the competition without creating a new iPhone every 6 months. Apps will sell more iPhones, and iPhones will sell more apps.
The ability to customize through software will just add to the experience and make it fresh and new and sort of keep up with the constantly changing consumer demands.
Apparently, one consumer demand is for an app called iPint, where you can drink a virtual glass of beer. It's incredibly popular, but necessary?
So far, I haven't found like any that I really, really need.
That's iPhone owner Mark Flores at an Apple store in Los Angeles.
I've downloaded maybe 16 to 20 apps, but they've all been the free apps.
Freebies aside, Apple CEO Steve Jobs says the App Store could eventually do $1 billion in annual sales. Probably an overstatement, according to some analysts, but they say Apple's competitors are sure to copy the business model. I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
The Olympics are going great guns, but Chinese investors have other things on their minds. The Shanghai Composite Index gave up more than 5% today. There were some new numbers out showing inflation there is still rising despite government efforts to cool things down. A couple of Goldman Sachs analysts said today they don't think the games are going to have much of an effect on the overall Chinese economy. But there are some up-and-coming companies that are trying to leverage the Olympics to get their names out. Here's Marketplace's Scott Tong.
Quick, name a Chinese brand you like. Stumped? If you are, that's the problem for Chinese consumer companies. This Olympic season, some of them hope to use sponsorships to vault themselves onto the world stage. Among them, beer maker Qingdao, what some Americans know as Tsingtao. The top domestic brewer in China is named for its home city on the eastern coast. Qingdao's international marketing efforts include a multilingual tourist trap. The company museum.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Qingdao Beer Museum.
Today, Qingdao the city is hosting Olympic sailing, and Qingdao the beer is sponsoring it. Several other Chinese sponsors of the games also have global aspirations. Haier, the appliance maker, sneaker company Li Ning, and Lenovo, which makes computers. They all hope to mimic the success of Japanese brands after the 1964 Tokyo Olympics, and of Korean companies after the 1988 Seoul Games. Normandy Madden edits the newsletter Ad Age China.
It took Japan maybe 3 or 4 decades to really develop really high-end products from companies like Sony and Toyota. It took Korea 10, 15 years, and China is maybe even faster. So it's definitely happening.
Happening, but not there yet. Madden considers many Chinese companies determined and aggressive, but they all suffer from what the pros call country of origin bias. i.e. the perception that made in China equals low-end. Take Haier, the appliance company.
The problem is that when people go into a Walmart to buy a refrigerator, they don't go in and say, I want to buy a Haier. They go in and say, I want to buy the cheapest thing you have, and they end up with a Haier.
The tin can reputation is a hard one to shake, but Japanese and Korean car makers managed to do it. Another hurdle for Chinese companies? Making innovative products. Tom Doctoroff is with the advertising firm J. Walter Thompson.
If you have that type of hierarchical culture where there is a great emperor on the top and everybody pays deference to that emperor, you're not going to have a free flow of ideas up and down.
And he says Chinese firms often go for the quick buck rather than invest in long-term brand and image building. The upshot? In his mind, there are no Chinese corporate Godzillas about to invade America.
There is not one Chinese brand that is anywhere closer than light years, okay, from being able to export its brand to developed markets at a premium. And I don't see any ships that are at the docks ready to sail.
The course many Chinese firms have charted is to stop first on the shores of emerging markets like Russia and the Middle East, and then eventually move on to Europe and North America. That's what Chinese automakers and consumer companies are doing. In the end, which brands will emerge as global competitors? Again, Normandy Madden of Ad Age China.
It's too soon to tell which ones are going to succeed. It's possible that the biggest Chinese brand 20 years from now hasn't even been created yet.
For now, though, every Chinese company with world-class aspirations is still toiling in the minor leagues. In Beijing, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Coming up, playing hardball with soft serve ice cream.
There's been situations where there are some drivers that get irate and they'll jump out of the car and they'll confront us. There was a driver that once pulled out a pipe and he was waving it around.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials moved up 0.4% today, 48 points to close at 11,782. The NASDAQ climbed 1%, 25 points. Finished at 2439. The S&P 500 added 0.6%, 7 points. Ended the day at 1304. General Motors revved up 7.25% today. CEO Rick Wagoner told a reporter that he thinks the worst of the company's problems, from job cuts to healthcare costs, are in the rearview mirror. American Axle and Manufacturing got serious traction today. Its shares zoomed up more than 15%. Investors gave home improvement stores a nice makeover. Home Depot and Lowe's each built up gains of more than 4% today. It was sunny in Seattle on this Monday. Amazon booked more than a 9% gain. Citigroup says it vastly underestimated the number of Kindle readers that Amazon's going to sell this year. Things were brewing down the viaduct at Starbucks, too. The coffee chain perked up almost 8%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 4% even. You're listening to Marketplace.
Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Sustainability Fund of the Tides Foundation, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet. Each song we choose for the rundown on Marketplace is there for a reason. If you hear one that resonates, you can find out what it is on our website. Head to marketplace.org and check out the songs on the right side of the screen. There's also a link to an online store where you can buy each song.
From the Marketplace Gatebook, here's a glance at events coming up Tuesday. The Treasury Department releases the federal budget for July. The Centers for American Progress and Democracy and Technology unveil a report on internet fraud. State attorney generals also weigh in on ways to protect online customers. And on this day in 1851, Isaac Singer stitched up his place in history by patenting the sewing machine. I'm Caitlin Carroll.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. After IndyMac collapsed a month or so ago, we all started paying a lot more attention to that sign on the doors of our banks, the one that says deposits insured up to $100,000, and then right in the middle are the letters FDIC, that one, right? The FDIC does guarantee our deposits, but it's not financed with taxpayer money. It's an insurance system. Banks pay premiums for that protection, just like you might for your home or your car. And when a financial storm like the one we're in hits, those premiums go up. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
Insurance rates that banks pay to the FDIC are likely to rise, and consumers could pay the price. William Isaac is a former chairman of the FDIC.
Obviously, any expense a bank has gets passed along.
He says banks could cut savings rates and hike interest on loans, but there's a bigger problem. For every dollar a bank holds on its books, it typically makes $10 in new loans. So if the FDIC increases insurance premiums this fall to raise $1 billion...
That's $10 billion it isn't going to get loaned to businesses and consumers.
And that's a drag on an economy that's already struggling.
I've always felt the time to raise deposit insurance premiums is not when times are bad, but when times are good.
That sounds like a smart strategy to James Chesson at the American Bankers Association. But he says recent banking losses have been so large, an FDIC rate hike is inevitable.
But hopefully as they see the revenue coming in, they would quickly start ratcheting down those premiums.
Next year, even without a rate hike, banks are expected to pay roughly $4 billion in premiums to the FDIC. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Whether it's the kind the FDIC offers or the kind we all buy, insurance is essentially a hedge, paying for the peace of mind of knowing you're covered if something goes wrong. Hedging is one of those terms that's bandied around a lot by financial types, but commentator Megan McArdle says more of us ought to do it in the more mundane parts of our lives.
Times are a little tough these days. Most of us are feeling, in Tom Lehrer's words, a little bit like a Christian Scientist with appendicitis. So why not do what the big financial boys do and hedge your bets? The technique is widely exploited in the financial world, but people rarely think to apply it to themselves. When I was getting my MBA, people put a lot of stock in getting a full-time offer from their summer internship. Towards the end of the summer, a few of us decided to hedge our net psychic wealth. We each put $75 into a pool. Those who got full-time offers lost the money, but gained a job. The people who didn't get offers got to divide the money. Merrill Lynch didn't offer me a full-time job, but I did get a lavish dinner at one of Chicago's best restaurants. I enjoyed the meal much more than I would have enjoyed working at Merrill Lynch. There are lots of opportunities to do this in everyday life. Start with your 401k. You've probably got a lot of company stock in it. This is exactly the wrong approach. Instead, you should buy stocks that do well when your company does badly. If you work at Nutrisystem, buy shares in Krispy Kreme. If you're an automotive engineer, short GM and invest the proceeds in ExxonMobil securities. The Case-Shiller Housing Index offers a similar opportunity. If you're saving up for a down payment, you can buy shares in your local index, which will pay off when prices rise. But if all your wealth is concentrated in your home, you should be able to short housing futures. If prices keep falling, you'll reap a profit. Worried about the outcome of a major event, promotion, house sale, even a marriage proposal? Why not find a few willing friends and bet against yourself? This strategy offers a bonus well beyond mental peace. You may find out that your friends have a lot more confidence in you than you have in yourself.
Megan McArdle is associate editor at The Atlantic magazine. She blogs there, too. You can go to marketplace.org if there is something on your mind. Click on that link that says contact. Depending on where you grew up, this music was the soundtrack to your summertime. Even today, when kids hear it, they know the Mr. Softy ice cream truck is coming. Problem is, Mr. Softy's competitors know it too, and they're not shy about cashing in. Mr. Softy is suing dozens of drivers it says copy the trademark look and sound of its trucks. Joel Rose reports.
It's a muggy afternoon in Brooklyn, and I'm driving around with Hillary Doc Guichard, who runs a Mr. Softy distributorship a few miles from here. It only takes us 20 minutes to find an ice cream truck that's not one of his.
Well, here's one right here. You see the blue at the bottom and the white at the top? This is a typical example of somebody trying to be a fake Mr. Softy.
This truck is only imitating the official Mr. Softy colors, but some of the alleged copycats are a lot bolder. They use the music, the name, even the trademarked graphics on the side of the truck.
This mark right here is what we call the cone head mark. It's a cone with the ice cream, vanilla ice cream on top and a smiley face and a bow tie. That picture is a registered trademark owned by Mr. Softy.
Jeffrey Zucker is the lawyer for Mr. Softy, Inc. He's filed trademark infringement suits against hundreds of ice cream truck owners. He has yet to lose a case.
Competition is fine, but unfair competition when someone uses our trademarks and operates trucks right in the same areas as our paying franchisees is not fun.
Those franchisees pay thousands of dollars a year in royalties just to use Mr. Softy's trademarks. That's on top of the $100,000 it takes to buy a real Mr. Softy truck.
All right, three vanilla sprinkles.
No, this one!
Oh, forget it. Two sprinkles, yeah. And
back in Brooklyn, Doc Guichard's customers have more pressing things to worry about. Guichard, who moved to the U.S. from the tiny Caribbean nation of Nevis, says the big losers in all this are the little guys, the franchisees who scrimp and save to start their own business.
I'm not able to maximize my potential as a Mr. Softy when there are copycats around who don't have the overhead that I have, but are still fooling the kids that they are Mr. Softy.
You don't think the kids distinguish?
They don't, because, you know, kids are impulsive buyers. All they see is a blue and white truck, and they start running, "Mommy, I want an ice cream."
Mr. Softy has been around since 1956. The New Jersey-based company today has more than 300 franchise operators in 16 states, but it's only in the last few years that Mr. Softy has gotten serious about protecting its trademarks. That's when the company hired a private investigator named Darren Giglio to get pictures of the phonies.
There's been situations where there are some drivers that get irate and they'll jump out of the car and they'll confront us. There was a driver that once pulled out a pipe and he was waving it around.
Right now, Mr. Softy has a lawsuit pending against 10 defendants in Brooklyn and Queens. Only one of them has a listed phone number, and he didn't return my calls. Mr. Softy Vice President Jim Conway says a lot of the people the company is suing are second- and third-time offenders who register their trucks under fake names each time.
As we gain the cooperation of the court and the damages become more punitive, people will have second thoughts about this because they know that we're going to pursue them aggressively.
But even Mr. Softy's private eye, Darren Giglio, isn't so sure.
It's been 6 years. We'll probably keep doing it, but some people just never learn.
Until they do, Mr. Softy will just have to keep playing hardball. In Philadelphia, I'm Joel Rose for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing nearly $9 billion in municipal bond assets. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today, one that might well make you think twice on your next trip to the produce aisle. A Japanese hotel manager has paid $910 for a bunch of grapes. Not a pound, but a bunch. 35 grapes, plus or minus. About $26 a grape, that works out to. They're a new variety, Ruby Roman, they're called. Fruit is generally rare in Japan, and it's often given as a luxury gift, which counts for the price. But what about the taste for all the money they cost? Quite delicious, said one Japanese agriculture official. Very well balanced, too, he said. Whatever that does mean for a grape. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 48 points, 0.4%. The NASDAQ added 25 points, that's 1%. The S&P 500 bumped up 0.7% there. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Coming up next time on the program, sales strike a high note at an Italian winery.
Some things are worth waiting for. Some things in fruit haste.
I was going to sing, but no chance. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.